Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and thanks so much for joining me today for another episode of It's All About Food. Would you believe this program is now in its 9th year? That's a lot of talking about food, my favorite subject. We cover a lot of topics on this program, most related to food. And today, we're going to be talking about food-related topics, of course. Two topics that people are uncomfortable talking about are death and bowel movements, right? But we've covered a lot of discussion about bowel movements on this show, so we're going to talk about the other topic. I like to quote my dad, who has a bunch of sayings, and he likes to say, "No one gets out of this world alive." And we haven't talked about death and dying, and we are going to do some of that today. I don't know if you've heard this, but Woody Allen once said, "I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens." What we're going to talk about today is, in relation to death, many things, including being prepared for it and being there when it happens. My guest today are the terrific trio, Carol Adams, Patty Brightman, and Ginny Messina. We've had them on this show before 3 years ago to talk about their book, Never Too Late to Go Vegan. And whenever you go vegan, early or late or never, their new book is for you, Even Vegans Die. What I'd like to do is introduce my guests one at a time. This way we can calibrate their voices and we know who is saying what. So let's start with Carol Adams. She's the author of the landmark book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, A Feminist Vegetarian Critical Theory, and The Pornography of Meat. Besides advancing scholarship and developing theory in the area of interlocking oppressions, Carol has created a series of books that address the vegetarian-vegan experience, Living Among Meat Eaters, The Vegetarian Survival Guide, Help, My Child Stopped Eating Meat, and The Inner Art of Vegetarianism, and Meditations on the Inner Art of Vegetarianism. She lives outside Dallas, Texas. Carol, welcome.
Thank you very much, Karen. It's an honor and thrill to be on your show today.
Thank you. It's such a privilege to talk to you always. Are you in Texas today?
Yes, and it's hot.
It's hot. Okay, that was the question. Welcome to global warming. All right, let's bring on Patty next. Patty Brightman is the co-founder of Dharma Voices for Animals and director of the Marin Vegetarian Education Group. She's the co-author of many books, including Even Vegans Die. She's on the Advisory Council of the Animals and Society Institute and Jewish Veg. In 2016, she was honored to receive the Lisa Shapiro Award for Unsung Vegan Heroes. Patty lives in Fairfax, California, where her neighbors and friends include coyotes, foxes, rabbits, bobcats, spiders, birds, snakes, deer, and countless other beautiful creatures. Patty, I'm sending you a hug. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me on again.
Yes. Well, I'm grateful that you are on the planet. And now let's bring on Ginny. Ginny is Virginia Messina, the co-author of Vegan for Life and Vegan for Her, and of the first textbook on vegetarian nutrition for medical professionals. She writes and speaks on vegan nutrition for both consumers and health professionals. Ginny serves on the board of directors of Veg Fund and on advisory boards of One Step for Animals, Veg Youth, and the Vegetarian Resource Group. She lives in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, with her husband and ever-changing population of rescued cats. And you can find out more about Ginny and lots of information at theveganrd.com. Ginny, hi.
Hi, Karen. It's great to be here. I think this is my third time on your show.
I think so, too. We talked about Vegan for Her, and then we talked about
Never Too Late to Go Vegan. Yeah.
Right. You know what? It might be your fourth, because I think we talked another time. Didn't you co-author another book?
I did. I co-authored a book 7 years ago with Jack Norris from Vegan Outreach, Vegan for Life.
Yeah, I think we talked about that, too.
We go way back.
Memories. Okay. Well, you're all doing wonderful work. And this particular book is an unusual one. So my first question is, whose idea was it to write Even Vegans Die?
Well, I have my version of the story. This is Patty. My co-authors may not share it, but I wanted to write an article. I didn't think we had enough for a book. I thought it was an article, and it was mostly to remind people to make sure they have a will and make sure they have an advance directive and make sure they take care of, right now when they're healthy, that everybody make sure they have plans for when they're no longer able to take care of their animals or take care of their possessions when we're not here. And Carol and Ginny promptly convinced me that it was more of a book than an article.
Well, it wasn't so prompt. This is Carol. We worked on Patty for about a month. She was willing to suspend her disbelief and see what we had. We were talking in March of 2016, catching up and talking about getting Never Too Late to Go Vegan into nursing homes and assisted living places, when we were all comparing notes about vegans who had died or Patty had just been the executor of a will. And we were talking about vegans who were ill and felt they weren't being supported by the vegan community. And I think at the same time that Patty said, well, we should do an article, Ginny and I had light bulbs above our heads saying this should be a book. And Patty delivered the title of the book immediately and eventually realized that Ginny and I were right, which is part of our great teamship. I don't know, how do you describe that? Our great camaraderie as co-authors. We learned how to benefit from each other's wisdom.
It wasn't the last time I came around to seeing that you were right.
We're all right. Now, it's amusing to me because Dr. Michael Greger wrote your foreword, and I remember when his book came out, How Not to Die, and I have to confess that it wasn't until I read the foreword that I really understood what he meant by his title. Even after interviewing him and reading his book, for some reason I didn't get it. But I understand now that his book, How Not to Die, didn't mean that we weren't going to die as vegans, that we weren't superhuman and invulnerable, but there were ways to reduce our risk and live a quality life of longevity so that we would die well, I guess. Something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was an interesting title when we first all saw it. Okay. So let's move on. There's a lot of wonderful things in this book, and yeah, Patty, you're right about wanting people to plan, because in our culture, nobody likes to talk about death. Nobody likes to think about death. And very often, people don't want to plan.
That's right.
It's almost a selfish thing,
exactly.
Not planning.
Exactly. It's a gift you can give to your loved ones and even your friends and your animals to take care of those details now. People are afraid that they're jinxing themselves if they make plans for when they die, when in fact they're giving a gift to people who care about them. Because on top of grieving, people who care about you don't want to have to start sifting through papers and going through legal problems and working with your superintendent to get into your apartment and looking through all your stuff. If you don't have a will, it's a big mess. And somebody's going to have to take care of that mess. And you want to name that person while you're alive, have conversations with that person while you're alive, make sure that you trust that person, and make sure that you've legally taken care of making that person official. Because unless they're the official person named in your will, they can't get your bank accounts. They can't close your Comcast account or your AT&T account. They can't do anything on behalf of your estate. And the word estate scares people. It doesn't mean you have to own a lot of stuff. If you have an apartment with a rug in it, you have an estate.
You know, I know a number of elderly people who have not prepared. And they've often talked to me about their treasures, the things that they own, the things that they want to make sure go to someone who will care for them or enjoy them, but they have made no plan to do that. It's heartbreaking.
Well, 60% of Americans have not made plans, and I found that out when Prince died. Prince died without a will, and that was a real loss of opportunity. He could have helped so many animal organizations. He could have left money to help all kinds of advocacy groups. He loved animals, and he could have done a lot to help them, but it's going to take years to straighten out that estate. And in fact, only 40% of American adults have wills, and it really is a shame. It should be up to 100%. And it doesn't have to be expensive. You can do it fast. You can always hire an estate attorney, estate planning attorney, or you can go to a website called GYST. That stands for Get Your, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this on air, it's Get Your Shit Together. Okay, getyourshittogether.com is abbreviated, GYST.com, and it's a wonderful website that talks you through the different companies that offer online will preparation services and compares them and tells you how you can do it.
Well, what I didn't know until recently is that you can actually write what you want and have two people witness it, and that will be acknowledged. But it has to be in the hands of someone who knows that it's there.
Karen, the rules vary by state. Some states will allow that and some states won't. And some states have rules like it has to be typewritten and it has to be notified. Some states don't. You have to go online and find out from one of these reputable companies that are listed on GYST.com. Find out what the requirements are in your state. It's not the same for everybody across the country.
Karen, I want to just point out, this is Carol, that you referred to, you know, some elderly people who haven't made wills. But our argument, and we were drawing on the insight of a young vegan activist in her 20s who is really advocating for everyone to make a will, that if you're an adult, you need a will. So we're not just writing to people over 50, over 60, over 70. Anyone in a vegan animal rights activist who's involved in the movement should have a will, especially if they are caring for animals. So that they can ensure that those animals have some sort of protection and care if they were to die. So I think our section on death and dying and on wills in particular is very helpful, but I would not want anyone to think we've only written this for people over a certain age. We've written adults.
I agree, and I want to say also that death is very democratic and very unpredictable. And sometimes you're in an accident. Even if you're the healthiest vegan on earth, you can get hit by, heaven forbid, you can get hit by a bus, you can get hit by a car, you can have a terrible unplanned accident. There are earthquakes, there are hurricanes, things happen. And people get hurt and people die. And not having a will is almost like a slap in the face to the people who care for you and the animals that you care for. If you don't have a plan in place, Carol, I think, told me this. Maybe it was Ginny. One of the most common calls at animal shelters is, come get this animal today or we're going to euthanize it because the person who took care of it is dead.
It is such an important point. I don't have any companion animals, but I never thought about it. And I'm sure people who do haven't thought about it either.
Well, I've heard about people who even have children who don't have wills, which is really scary. I mean, it's just as scary as having dogs and cats and other animals. Without a will, you're putting your loved ones, whether they're human or not, you're putting them in danger.
Right. Now, you cover early in the book some very important concepts. When many of us are vegan, we think we're invulnerable. We think that this lifestyle, this diet, is going to save us from everything. And then when we hear that one of our fellow vegans has fallen ill or died, it's almost scandalous. And
yeah, it is.
We really shouldn't have that opinion.
Well, why don't we let Ginny, Ginny worked very hard on that first part to talk about how we have ended up looking at veganism in a sort of inaccurate way. Ginny?
Yeah, you know, we talked about the issue of disease shaming, and there's no doubt about the fact that eating a healthy vegan diet and engaging in other lifestyle habits is going to impact your risk of getting certain diseases. But that's about improving odds, and it's not a guarantee.
based on what we know right now, we don't have complete control over our health. And so when we get sick or when other vegans get sick, it is just not fair to second guess why they got sick, whether they were eating the wrong kind of diet, whether they weren't doing everything that they're supposed to do. It's not fair to suggest that they were doing something wrong, because we don't have all of these answers. And this is something that that morphs into this whole idea of disease shaming. It places vegans who are sick in a very uncomfortable position. They don't feel like they can ask for the kind of support that they need. They don't feel like they can really share what's going on with them. They kind of feel alienated from the vegan community. And we talked with lots and lots of people while we were writing this book, people, vegans who have various chronic diseases, who are, you know, struggling with poor health. And this was something that we heard from them over and over and over again, is that they felt alienated from the vegan community because they felt like they weren't supposed to get sick. They weren't being good models of vegan health and energy. And the fact is that, you know, this can happen to anybody. Anybody can get cancer. Anybody can get heart disease, no matter what you're doing with your diet and your lifestyle.
Sometimes we put that self-judgment on ourselves. And I know I had advanced ovarian cancer with a 10 to 20% survival rate. And I remember one of my first social outings after my diagnosis, and Martin Rowe, the co-founder of your publisher, Lantern Books — we love Lantern Books — he knew, and he came up to me and said, he just said, you know, do you want to talk? And I felt at that event like I was wearing the scarlet letter. I felt like I was wearing a big C. And it was just really great to sit down with him. He is very sensitive and understanding, and it really helped. And I don't feel like I'm wearing a big C anymore, but I do feel like I'm part of a club. Those who have had cancer. It's a club. But I'm a vegan, and I've had cancer, and I've moved on.
I think one of the things that we want to make clear in this early part is that by excluding anyone who doesn't seem to have perfect health, we've not only injured the vegan movement that loses diversity because of that, but those who aren't vegans who might be looking to see if there's anyone like them who are vegans won't find them. So again, we do disservice to vegans who need our care and love and inclusion in from potlucks to activism and to the outside world as well. So we really feel it's important to get beyond this sort of fixation on veganism as health. We're not arguing that it doesn't do anything. We know that there are statistics and that there are ways to work towards health, but we are saying that it's no guarantee that you won't get Crohn's disease or acne or cancer or any other kind of disease.
Yeah, shit happens.
Yeah, one of the things I like about the book — this is Patty again — and Ginny and Carol really made this clear to me. When somebody does have a diagnosis that's serious, whether it's cancer or heart disease or anything else, the first reaction should never be, how did that happen? The first reaction should be, I'm so sorry that you're going through this. I love the chapter about how to show up for people who are sick, because we tend to want to distance ourselves and make it clear that can't happen to me because I didn't do whatever you did. If somebody had, even whenever you hear somebody has lung cancer, the first reaction was, did he smoke? Instead of, I'm so sorry to hear that. And we have to train ourselves as vegans who take pride and we're so compassionate. We have to relearn how to be compassionate to our fellow humans, not only to animals, but every human we encounter deserves our compassion as well. And I think the book goes a long way to teach people how to do that in practical ways.
Yes, it does. There were a few things that I liked. I liked your discussion of the ring theory. And you can go into detail about the ring theory. One of the things that I liked about it, you group people in rings in order of importance to the person who's affected, who's in the center. And whatever ring you're in, you don't complain inward. You only complain outward.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And that's from a Los Angeles op-ed. But the important point is that those of us, say, who are friends or relatives of the person in the middle, we can't go to the person in the middle and ask them to take care of our feelings. We can't. It's you care in and dump out. We can turn to someone who knows that person less or who doesn't know that person at all and say, God, I feel pity about this. This is awful. But we don't dump in. We care in and we dump out. Once you have an insight into the ring theory, then you understand the kind of things that are inappropriate to say to the person in the middle. Not just, you know, did you cheat as a vegan? Or have you tried some cure that you believe is appropriate? And to non-vegans to say, try a vegan diet at this point. It's not for us to suddenly have all the remedies and all the solutions and imply they don't know what they're doing.
I certainly got a lot of that. I got a lot of recommendations of what I should have been doing when I was going through my own treatment. And it was just good to read the ring theory. I think it's wonderful. There can be people who are very close to you that will complain even when they want to help. And I remember having to remind some of them, you're here for me, and this is what I want now. And it's not about you right now. It's about me. Huh. So I would like everyone to learn more about the ring theory. It's really brilliant. The other thing that I enjoyed, which I know is not your creation, but another important thing to know about, are the five wishes.
Yes, the five wishes.
Can someone talk about that?
Sure. The five wishes are, it's a way, they have so many names for this. It's an advanced directive, and it has a lot of other names. Sometimes it's called the living will. And basically, the five wishes is a free form you can get online by going to five wishes. I'll get the exact name in a minute. It's in the index of our book, in our resource section. The five wishes allow you to have emotional and spiritual and personal observations and thoughts, as well as legally binding advanced directives. So it tells people how you want to be cared for at the end of your life. It tells people what you do and you don't want. And it's a form that makes it easier to do that. So I highly recommend it. It asks you questions, and it can replace an advanced directive or be your advanced directive. It asks you basically, who do you want to make healthcare decisions for you when you can't? And what kind of medical treatment do you want or don't want? If you have a terminal illness and you have a heart attack while they're treating the illness, do you want to be revived or not? And how comfortable do you want to be? Do you want to just have drugs to ease the pain, or do you want to be conscious and very aware of the pain, if there is pain? And how do you want people to treat you? And what do you want your loved ones to know? That, to me, is one of the most important things that differentiates the five wishes from any advanced directive. You can leave, it's almost like writing a letter to your loved ones and saying, this is what I want you to know if I die suddenly and I can't tell you, you know, I want you to know I was proud of you, or I want you to know I loved you, or I want you to know, whatever it is, the five wishes helps you do it.
And Karen, this is Jenny. One of the things about our book is that we looked at a lot of these tools and these resources that have been developed for the general population. They're not developed specifically for vegans. And we looked at the ways that these can really be, that they can specifically help vegans and be relevant to people who are living a vegan lifestyle. Because the five wishes gets really specific. You can list, for example, the kinds of personal care products that you want used. If you can no longer take care of yourself, what kinds of body lotion do you want people to put on you? And you can specify that you only want cruelty-free products to be used. You can specify that you want your pets to be with you at all times. So there are lots of issues here that are really relevant and specific to vegans.
That is indeed very important, not just when we're dying, but any time that we're ill or going to a hospital.
Right.
Because, I didn't plan, and they were smearing all kinds of crap on me that I didn't want on my body.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well.
I have a friend who hikes a lot with me, and she hikes on her own sometimes, and she fell on a hike and broke her wrist and couldn't get home. And thank goodness, a number of her friends knew where she, well, some of us took her to the hospital, but some of us knew that she kept a key to the house and the boot that she keeps outside her door, the rain boot, and we could get in and take care of her animals.
Mm.
But if you don't have to die, if you do get ill and something happens that keeps you from getting home, who's going to walk your dog? Who's going to feed your cat?
Okay, everybody, I hope you're getting this message because it applies to all of us, no matter what you eat.
Karen, I just want to jump in. I know that we don't have much time left to talk. Just mention that we also draw or suggest that this inability of our culture to deal honestly with death and dying may have something to do with our attitudes towards animals. And so it becomes not just something vegans should do because we live in a human community and we're not benefiting our friends and relatives if we fail them by seriously our own death and dying, but also that by talking honestly about death and dying, we may take some of the negative association it has that has been placed and burdened upon animals. So we have, in a sense, a much more radical reason to talk about death and dying, and that our own experience of mourning for animals offers some insights and help into this conversation. So we really do link all of this and also how the ethics of care would inform both how we are activists for animals and how we care for our friends and relatives if they are ill or dying.
That's beautiful. And thank you, Carol. Leave it to you to connect the dots that most people never even know are there to connect. Okay, well, Patty, Carol, and Ginny, thanks once again for joining me on It's All About Food and for putting together this very important practical guide, Even Vegans Die, which is a practical guide to caregiving, acceptance, and protecting your legacy of compassion. Be well, all of you. Live long lives.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you
too.
Karen.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Oh, okay. Did you take notes? Did you get that? Such important information. Okay. You know what? I just thought before we move on to the next part of the program, I wanted to read a little poem. It's something that I learned when I was in junior high school or high school, I think. It's we were assigned to read a book called Death Be Not Proud, a 1949 memoir by an American author, John Gunther. And he took the name of the book from a poem, actually a holy sonnet by John Donne, who lived from 1572 to 1631. And the book talks about a true story of the author's son, teenage son, who struggled to overcome a brain tumor and his ultimate death at 17. And the character in the book was really inspirational. His caregivers were inspirational. Something that was interesting is that they did attempt to use the Gerson diet. You may be familiar with that. It's a diet that uses a lot of juicing. And unfortunately, ultimately it did not save his life, because sometimes these remedies don't work for everyone. They may work for a lot of people, but not for everyone. Anyway, here's the poem that I had to learn from memory when I was a teenager. Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou thinkest thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me from rest and sleep, which but thy pictures be much pleasure, then from thee much more must flow. And soonest our best men with thee do go, rest of their bones and soul's delivery. Thou art slave to fate, chance, kings, and desperate men, and dost with poison, war, and sickness dwell, and poppy or charms can make us sleep as well, and better than thy stroke. Why swell'st thou then? One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die. One more quote from Steve Jobs. If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right. Okay, a quick break, and we'll be back with the second part of our show, talking with Eunice Wong and the book, What the Hell? I'm Karen Hartglass, and we're back with the second part of the show. Thanks for joining me today. It's time to take a really good breath. And what's fantastic about breathing right now, breathing in the month of June here in New York, my favorite tree, the linden tree, is starting to bloom, and it is the most amazing fragrance anywhere. We have a linden tree growing quite tall in front of our terrace, and it hasn't bloomed yet, and it better bloom soon. But it's just wonderful to smell that air. And it's summer. Happy summer to everyone. Okay, let's move on. I would like to introduce my next guest. Eunice Wong is a multi-award-winning actor, writer, editor, and teacher. Her most recent book that we're going to be talking about today, What the Health, is the official companion book to the documentary of the same name. She also wrote The Sustainability Secret, the official companion book to the documentary Cowspiracy. And she was a recent speaker at the 2017 Asheville Vegan Fest in North Carolina. There's a lot more to learn about Eunice Wong, and you can go to her website, eunicewong.com. Right now, we're going to be talking about What the Health. Hi, Eunice. How are you today?
Hi, Karen. I'm well. How are you?
Good. I am well. Thank you. It's nice to be well. We just spent the last half hour talking about being prepared.
I know.
About death
I heard
and
the
dying.
Interview, and it was fascinating and so needed. I mean, such a necessary addition to the sort of vegan literature that's out there.
I know. No one gets out of this world alive.
No, that's true.
But why shouldn't we feel as good as we can for as long as we can?
Yep, that's true. There's a quote, there's an interview with Dr. Neil Barnard in What the Health, and he says, while we're alive, let's be alive.
Mm. So many people believe as we age that pain is normal, that high blood pressure is normal.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not.
Yeah, it's not. And you guys talked about Dr. Greger's book, How Not to Die. He actually talked in that book about how people don't die of old age. They die of disease. So old age itself is not the thing that gives us our aches and pains and the inflammation and the arthritis. It's something going you know, awry in the body.
You cover everything in this book that's related to food and health, and even more than that. We talk a lot on this show. I've been doing this show. I'm in the ninth year now. So we've talked about food and the horrors of dairy and meat and chicken and fish and GMOs and organic food versus conventional. And it's all in this book. What I want to talk about are the things that I find the scariest to me, because even though I take the time and the care to buy the best food I possibly can, organic whenever possible, and I'm major vegan, and I choose the foods that I believe are the healthiest for me, and I make them fabulously delicious, there's a number of things that are out of my control that are especially scary, and you talk about them in this book. So let's start with one scary topic, which is antibiotic resistance.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so antibiotic resistance. Dr. Margaret Chan, who was the Director General of the World Health Organization, I'm not sure if she was the first one to bring it up, but she brought it up in a WHO meeting in 2011 on World Health Day. And she said that this era of post-antibiotic resistance is coming upon us, and it is a global health crisis. And one of the major drivers of post-antibiotic era is the enormous, inconceivable amounts of antibiotics that are poured into the feed of animals that we raise for food and, you know, for their secretions, because they're kept in such appalling conditions that that's like one of the, it gives them a remote chance of surviving, basically, to have this antibiotic into their systems constantly, even if they're not sick. And so these animals develop antibiotic resistance, which means that they develop diseases and infections that are literally resistant to the antibiotics and then become untreatable. And then the human workers in the factory farms also contract that antibiotic resistance and bring it out into the human community. And the problem with this, of course, is that our antibiotics are now failing. And the danger of a post-antibiotic era is that you could die potentially from an infection contracted from scraping your knee on the sidewalk, or if you get strep throat, or the most basic medical procedures, what we consider basic today, would be extremely dangerous because we would no longer have the antibiotics to render those operations safe.
It's extremely frightening, and it's not fair.
It's absolutely not fair. Yeah.
It's not fair to me. I'm being selfish right now.
I know.
Well, I've spent decades doing the best that I can.
One of the titles that Kip and Keegan were considering for their film originally was Secondhand Eating. And that's exactly what it is. Because you always hear about secondhand smoking, right? That's why people give smokers the dirty looks when they're in crowded spaces. Because you're like, okay, I'm inhaling your carcinogens. That should not be happening. But it's secondhand eating because the eating habits of our country, of our culture, are in so many ways, I mean, many ways beyond antibiotic resistance, are affecting the lives of those of us who are attempting to eat as healthfully as we can and not to support these systems of, you know, factory farming. And it's absolutely unfair. Yeah.
I think, you know, I don't want to believe in the doomsday theory, but I sometimes I call myself, I don't know what it is, an optimistic pessimist, pessimistic optimist. I like to stay happy and optimistic, but I really think we're doomed. and antibiotic, the plague could be one of them, you know, this antibiotic resistance. It's either we're going to melt or the plague or maybe a combination.
Yeah, I mean, I know we're not here to talk about climate change, but I am so terrified about global warming. And of course, the animal agriculture industry blends into that. But I think it is a combination of stuff. It's the climate, and the climate will affect our food supply. And, you know, it's everything is interconnected. Like, I love Carol Adams' work because she connects the dots between feminism and veganism. And it's the same here. The connections between the environmental movement, the animal rights movement, the health movement, they're interrelated, and you really can't pull them apart without tugging on another thread that belongs to another movement. And that's what I think people need to realize, that, you know, great, if you want to become vegan because you want to lose 20 pounds, that's one thing. But, you know, we really need to start looking at everything holistically, and nothing's going to change until we do that.
Okay, let's connect these dots a little bit. I want to mention, I didn't mention this before, but you also wrote with Kip Anderson and Keegan Kuhn, The Sustainability Secret, which was the companion book to their movie, Cowspiracy. And I spoke with them. That was about, I don't know, 3 years ago or so on this program. But you talked about the United States government in your book and the policies or the lack of policies or the policies that aren't followed. And here's one where we can talk about the connection between the environment and health, where scientists were preparing guidelines for the USDA. And they actually came out and said that the environment affects our health and should be part of the nutrition guidelines. And then all the lobbyists came along and said, no, that's out.
Yeah. Yep. And the lobbyists and the government are an enormous part of the problem. I mean, the meat, dairy, and egg industries spend at least $138 million, I believe, lobbying Congress alone a year. That's just Congress. And the government wants that money to keep coming in, and so they return the favor. And each $1 industry contribution, each of those $1 of that $138 million results usually in a $2,000 return as federal tax subsidies. So it's like this, you scratch my back, you scratch mine, and I'll scratch yours. And the one who's left out of the equation is the American public, who's illnesses are being turned into a money-making commodity. I mean, we really are. Like, our heart disease, our cancers, our diabetes are a money-making engine just as much as the pigs in their gestation crates or the dairy cows.
There are many people who feel that it's their right to be able to consume whatever they want. And they get very aggravated when they hear people like us, maybe we're not in their face, but talking about these issues related to food and what's healthy and what isn't. And they have no idea how manipulated they have been. And
yeah.
they talk about this right, this free choice.
Mm-hmm.
And their decisions aren't made from free choice.
Yeah.
Their decisions have been made from marketing brainwashing.
I know. Well, one of the most creepy things in the research for the film and this book are the government checkoff programs. That's
mm-hmm.
like check it off, not as in Anton Chekhov, unfortunately.
we love
it. I know, because that when I first heard it, I heard it rather than read it, and I was like, Chekhov programs, that sounds amazing. But no, it has nothing to do with the Russian playwright.
And Chekhov, so, I'm digressing here, but he was an environmentalist.
Yeah, he was an amazing man in so many ways. He was aware of so many of these problems.
Yes. Okay,
yeah,
back to the government Chekhov problem.
Yeah, a little theater geek moment there. So these checkoff programs, they are incredible, and most people don't know about them, even though they've seen the fruits of them. Everyone's seen these advertising campaigns like milk, it does a body good, beef, it's what's for dinner, pork, the other white meat. But people don't realize that these are government-run, federal government-run advertising schemes for specific food industries like milk, like beef, like pork. And how it works is that each producer of these foods are taxed a certain amount. I don't know the amounts, but for instance, like, say, the dairy industry, everyone is taxed a dollar a gallon, whatever. And then that dollar, the hypothetical dollar, gets put into this enormous fund, which is then run by the USDA. And so they have this huge amount of money, and the government will run these advertising programs to promote these foods to the public so that the public will keep buying them and keep, you know, supporting the animal agriculture industries, which then send their millions of dollars to the government in lobbying money. And the checkoff programs also run advertising for something they called industry trendsetters. So something like McDonald's or Domino's Pizza or Wendy's, they're industry trendsetters because they can sell a certain amount of dairy in cheese or in beef or in pork, in bacon. And so an advertising campaign like Wendy's Bacon Double Cheeseburger is a government program. And in fact, the Supreme Court ruled that these checkoff programs are government speech because they are administered by the USDA and created by Congress. And so we have government speech. It's very Big Brother, very 1984, telling us that we should eat these foods that mountains of scientific literature have revealed are literally killing us, you know, placing us in chronic health conditions, chronic diseases, and or killing us.
Oh, I have to take a deep breath every time I hear this stuff. I mean, I know it, and then I hear it, and it's...
I know.
It just gets me in my gut.
I know, and now, I feel like information, knowledge, getting this knowledge out, like, we do know it, and every time I hear it, I feel this thing in my gut, too. But so many people don't know it, and that's the big obstacle, I feel like, to change. It's like, if people knew this and changed their buying habits, I mean, I always say that being vegan is the most direct action that you can make. You know, what can you do about the fossil fuel industry? What can you do about building wind turbines onshore and offshore? Not a whole lot, unless you have, like, billions of dollars. But as a vegan, you can, you know, direct action every single day, three times a day. And I don't know if you saw in the New York Times recently, there was a feature of this nonprofit called, what was it called? It was called Project Drawdown.
Oh, yes, and I'm going to be speaking with Paul Hawken in a few months, yes.
Yeah, it's an international coalition of climate scientists who have sort of ranked the methods of most effectively halting or slowing down, at least, global warming. And, you know, the first one was, like, manage refrigerants, like the disposal of refrigerators and air conditioners. Second one was wind turbines onshore. Third one was food waste. And the fourth one was a plant-based diet. And they said in their website that eating a plant-based diet is probably the most effective thing an individual can do to affect climate change.
To affect everything.
Can you tell I'm obsessed?
Everything. It affects everything.
Yes, it does.
Everything. Climate change. Healthcare costs. Down. Everything.
Yeah. Right.
Oh. Anyway, I've been talking about this for years, but it's great to see it come together, not only in a book, but in a film. And I'm not sure which I prefer because they both have a value. So what I like in the book is you can really sit and savor every horrible piece of information that's in there as you learn it and see the references. And then... let's take an example. The film opens with the doctor who's the chief scientist at the American Diabetes Association. And if you don't believe in the book that this man actually says what he says, you can see it.
You can see it, yes.
There's no there's no amount of editing, you know, like reality show editing,
exactly,
to make him appear any different. You see it all.
Yeah.
In the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or he denies evidence.
Well, yeah, and he just shuts Kip down. I mean, Kip asks a very simple question about a study, and he's not, you know, he's not getting in his face or being argumentative. He's literally just asking a question. And this guy just shuts him off, and he says, I'm not going to go there. The interview is over. Goodbye. And it's like, wow, what just happened? That was very, very strange.
Now, this guy, does he know he's in this film?
I'm sure he does, and I don't know if he's had any reaction to it, but I'm sure he must know that he's in the film. Yeah, I love the film. I've seen it so many times. I've seen it in tons of rough cuts. And what I love about the film is that you can sit down and in 90 minutes get the gist of this argument. And what I love about the book is that because I had so much more space in the book and I had unlimited access to the hundreds, literally hundreds of hours of interviews that Kip and Keegan did with these amazing people who appear in the film, I could go through the entire transcript. And whereas they were limited to a few minutes of showing the interview, I could put in enormous chunks of the interviews that never appeared in the film, and sort of follow different paths. Like there's a whole section on George McGovern in the book that doesn't appear in the film that I love, because 40 years ago, this man tried to tell the American public that eating animal products was a public health concern. And he was shut down by the animal agriculture industries. And it's this, you know, on the one hand, very disheartening, and on the other hand, extremely inspiring, because he was trying to tell the truth. And I feel like now the truth is starting to come out, and we just have to keep on doing that. You know, we can't be discouraged by the billions of dollars that these industries have, or the sort of like the negative press that the dairy industry is throwing onto the soy milk industry, because now the soy milk industry is taking a bite out of the dairy industry. We just have to keep on telling people and spreading the word.
You know, some people would maybe criticize and say you're trying to create conspiracy theories. And I just know firsthand, for example, my grandfather, who I've never met because he died when my dad was six, he was a milkman in the 30s. And this was during a time of something called the Milk Wars. And he was a union activist trying to get a better deal for the milk deliverers because they just kept cutting the price. And the people that were struggling were the people, the farmers that were making the milk and the deliverers, everybody except, I guess, some powerful people who were in control of the whole business. They murdered him.
Oh, my God.
Murdered him. Murder Incorporated. And I mean, there's no telling what can happen when people are in a position of power and making a lot of money, and what they will do to keep it.
Yeah, and I often hear questions about bias, like, oh, you're just biased. You want everyone to be vegan because of the environment or because of the animals. And I just say, you know, look at the facts. Like, for instance, Kaiser Permanente, which is one of the country's largest nonprofit health plans, began advocating in 2013 for its, like, something like 17,000 doctors to actively and, you know, firmly encourage their patients to avoid eating animal products, because for them, it's in their best interest. They're an insurance company. Of course they want people to be healthy. And so they're looking at the science saying, wait a minute, if people are eating the standard American diet, we're going to have to pay out all of this money so that they can have their heart bypasses and their stents and their chemotherapy and whatever else. But they're doing it for the money, you know, of course. But they're asking their doctors to tell, to educate their patients to be plant-based. You know, that's not bias. That's just that's the fact. That's scientific evidence.
Yes, and then you have to educate the doctors. And as you talked in your book about a recent law that Dr. John McDougall tried to put forward in California.
California. Mm-hmm.
It didn't go very well.
No. And that was the amazing thing, because it was the medical associations who were fighting back against having nutrition education for doctors. They said that it was too much time. I think Dr. McDougall initially asked for 12 hours every 4 years of nutrition education, and then they cut it down to 12 and got cut down to 7, and then it got cut down to 0, and that's when the bill passed. So,
yeah, it has a lot of meat in it, that bill. Okay, Eunice, we have 2 minutes left, and I just want to know, how did you come to where you are with your philosophy about veganism?
I watched Cowspiracy, very honestly.
Wow.
And I was shocked, because I'd always considered myself an environmentalist, and I didn't know anything that was in that film. And I was absolutely shocked, and I just felt like I couldn't live with the hypocrisy of now knowing what I know and continue to eat animal products and say that I want this earth to thrive and to be sustainable. And the more I learned, I veered off from environmentalism. I learned about the horrific conditions on factory farms. Of course, I spent a lot of time researching this book on health. And the more I learn, the more, as I said, everything is connected. And there's just no way that I would ever live any other way now that I know what I know. And I have to live by my own beliefs, which are about the environment, which are about compassion and nonviolence, and, you know, being healthy so that we can continue to fight for change.
Yes. Well, Eunice, thank you very much for joining me today. And it's all about food. And I believe we should all be living what we believe in.
Yes. Yes,
and what absolutely. The hell can help you. So read the book, see the documentary. Thank you for joining me again on It's All About Food. We have just a minute left, and I wanted to remind you that we have a nonprofit. It's called Responsible Eating and Living. You can find us at responsibleeatingandliving.com. It's a mouthful, I know, but you know, we do have mobile apps, which you can get once you arrive at the website to make it easier to get there all the time. I use that app all the time to get my own recipes. When I want to make breakfast, for example, we have a daily blog called What Vegans Eat. So if you've learned from the book or the documentary, What the Health, that you want to go vegan, you don't know how, here's one tool that can help you. This daily blog, What Vegans Eat, it's linked to recipes. I hope you'll join me there. And if you have any comments and questions, you can find me at info@realmeals.org. We've come to the end of another program. Thank you so much for joining me, and have a delicious week.